This week on the Best of Flashpoints, President Barack Obama lays out his plans for an expanded escalation of the occupation of Afghanistan. We'll get analysis from Robert Knight and Dar Jamail. Also, we speak with Private Michael Kern, an active duty soldier stationed at Fort Hood, who is also a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He talks about the effect that repeated deployments and growing post-traumatic stress disorder has on the military. Also, we speak with members of military families speak out about their sons and relatives sent to wage Obama's war. And Rami El-Maghadi reports from the occupied Gaza Strip about recent Israeli invasions and shootings into Gaza as the suffocating blockade continues. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
America, we are passing through a time of great trial. And the message that we send in the midst of these storms must be clear, that our cause is just, our resolve unwavering. We will go forward with the confidence that right makes might, and with the commitment to forge an America that is safer, a world that is more secure, and a future that represents not the deepest of fears, but the highest of hopes. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Barack Obama speaking for approximately 35 minutes at West Point, announcing an escalation in the war in Afghanistan, saying it is in the vital national interests to expand this war. Again, this is a special edition devoted to covering this speech and the expansion. I'm Dennis Bernstein, and joining us in New York City is Robert Knight.
Dennis, it was a typical Obama speech that closed with great rhetorical flourish. In the concluding part, he spoke of economic recovery, of nuclear controls around the world, of nuclear materials, of diplomacy, of American values. He said this country does not stand for torture, although he is supporting a return of the Patriot Act or an extension of the Patriot Act, which does infringe on certain constitutional liberties. He says that the United States represents global security, scientific progress, and human decency. And he said, and here this is almost a direct quote, he said, "The United States has not sought global domination or the occupation of foreign nations." He said that there's a better future in freedom and opportunity, and he referred to a noble struggle for freedom in this new age of a nation for, by, and of the people, etc., etc. But the most important part of the speech came earlier on, in which he began with the obligatory reference to September 11, 2001, referring to Al-Qaeda's bases in Afghanistan that led to those attacks. He said that they were, quote, harbored by the Taliban, but he did not point out that the Taliban itself was created by the United States with the assistance of Pakistani intelligence as a countermeasure against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan through the Contra Mujahideen movement. He said that Hamid Karzai, the United States installed president there, along with the international forces in Afghanistan, have brought, quote, a lasting peace to a war-torn country. President Obama also said that when he came into office, there were 32,000 American troops in Afghanistan. Now, Obama has already sent 34,000 troops, 21,000 in March of this year, and lesser known, 13,000 so-called enablers and advisors, non-combat troops. So he's already sent in 34,000 and announced a 30,000 increase tonight. That means that now two-thirds of the troops in Afghanistan will have been there as a result of President Obama's escalation, a 2-to-1 margin over the number sent by President George W. Bush. He said it's in the vital national interest for him to send 30,000 more troops there. And here, in a very carefully worded phrase, he says that in 18 months, those troops will, quote, begin to come home. Now, White House sources are saying that the plan for civilianizing and Vietnamizing or Afghanistizing the occupation, that is something that will take years to train nearly a half million police and troops in Afghanistan. And sources inside the administration are saying they see an occupation that will last well into the year 2018. So the beginning of the end is being clad as an escalation today. And one other thing, the immediate dispatch that Obama is planning of 9,000 or 10,000 Marines to the Helmand province in southern Afghanistan is, of course, going to push into a greater turbulence in the Baluchistan province of of Pakistan. In fact, Yusuf Ghilani, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, complained about that very point in his conversations over the weekend with President Obama. He said that he would not allow al-Qaeda a safe haven inside Afghanistan, but not only will there be the regional conflict in the Pakistani-Afghani border region, but now in northern Africa, where it is understood that many of the al-Qaeda international jihadis have moved. One other thing, Dennis, the intelligence and military sources of the Obama administration itself says that the effectiveness of al-Qaeda and the presence of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is negligible, that there's barely 100 or so still left there doing anything of any significance. And one other thing, he did say that he refuted the argument that his escalation is analogous to that of Vietnam, about which we'll have more in just a short time.
For your just desserts, it's not just the words. Some of y'all heads up in the cloud, I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black back to burn. Boy, what y'all talking about? Out your mouth, I'm not concerned, cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turn like Detroit Red when his head had an ultra perm. The long walk, I earned your bare heels, so throw on your boots. The game camouflage like army suits, but I can see it more clear cause I came with the coupe in here. Ring the alarm, inform the troops, send them out into the world, go to war on a fluke. Eye to eye with the enemy you sworn to shoot. Now I'm coming at your neck, sick of hearing something wrong with me, something wrong with you. When the chief just way too smart to question.
And now from New York City, the Night Report with Robin Knight.
In today's Night Report, in Afghanistan, Obama beats Bush by a 2-1 margin. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Hundreds of thousands of protesters in the United States, Europe, Asia, and worldwide demonstrated today against the latest expansion of the Asian regional war in Afghanistan. Last night at West Point, President Barack Obama doubled his prior escalation of 34,000 troops with the announcement of an additional 30,000 to be sent starting as early as the new year. In so doing, Obama became personally responsible for more than a two-thirds majority of the 100,000 American soldiers, sailors, Marines, and reservists who will be in the occupied nation. That means that the peace president, Barack Obama, will have dispatched more than twice the 32,000 troops originally sent there by the war president, George Bush. Meanwhile, the American president is getting a little help from his friends in Europe. NATO is stepping up to shore up the overstretched military reserves of the United States with a promise to send at least 5,000 more European troops to support Washington's escalation. NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen insisted that, quote, this is not just America's war, this is our fight together, end quote. However, the number includes at least 1,500 sent there to supervise Hamid Karzai's stolen election and will simply be kept there rather than returning home. Britain is on deck for 500 more, with 600 from Poland and as many as 900 from the Western-backed government in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Italy, Germany, and France are noncommittal, pending a regional conference in late January. The new numbers of foreign troops in Afghanistan, soon to approach 150,000, means that there will be a lopsided ratio of 150 foreign soldiers for every presumed member of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That's according to President Obama's own National Security Council, which currently estimates that there are at most 100 of the international jihadis from al-Qaeda inside Afghanistan. An even larger ratio exists in the measure of dollars per troop. It will cost American taxpayers at least $1 million per soldier per year for the Obama escalation. Accordingly, with a new tax burden of at least $30 to $50 billion a year from the Obama escalation, congressional Democrats are now providing cover for the president's budgetary negligence with proposals for a new war tax to last throughout most of the next decade. House Appropriations Committee Chair David Obey has proposed a new income tax known in Newspeak as the, quote, Share the Sacrifice Act of 2010, end quote. That's actually the name of the bill, which hopes to defray the more than $1 trillion cost of the Obama escalation. But the price tag for it could easily slip into the multiple trillions over the decade or more that observers expect the U.S. troops to stay. In a masterful stroke of word work, Obama never said when the occupation would end, only when the alleged withdrawal would start. On two occasions in his West Point speech, Obama merely referred to the beginning and not the completion of the withdrawal. Obama said only that, quote, after 18 months, our troops will begin to come home, end quote. And later in the speech that he would, quote, begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011, end quote. And that's some of the news of this Wednesday, December 2nd, 2009. Reporting live from New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoint.
Thanks, Robert. This is Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, as everybody knows by now. And you heard it on the Knight Report. President Barack Obama, who campaigned heavily on a peace platform, has decided to greatly escalate the war against Afghanistan. As one writer for the Huffington Post put it, quote, after the Bush years of outright lies and systematic deception, we now have the Obama administration plumbing new depths as he torches the very language itself. 1984, here we are again. Escalation is withdrawal. Today on Flashpoints, we devote the first part of the show to a reaction from soldiers, military families, and anti-war activists. First, we go to the streets of San Francisco, where we're joined by one of the strongest opponents to the war I know, Richard Becker of the International Answer Coalition. Where are you, Richard? What's going on in the streets today? Why are you there?
I'm down here at Powell and Market Street in the middle of San Francisco, and people are just gathering. It looks like there will be hundreds of people here in a little while. And people are here to reject this escalation, the latest escalation. And, you know, this is by the end of his first year in office, after all the hopes that people had that Obama meant real change, there will be more troops in Iraq and Afghanistan than at any time during the tenure of George W. Bush.
All right, and so there is a protest in San Francisco. I understand that there are protests in Los Angeles, major cities across the country, and protests around the world.
I understand that there's at least, this is what we know, so I'm sure it's many more, that there's at least 65 demonstrations taking place today in the United States. There were many yesterday. I'm sure that there are many more, and I'm sure that there are many around the world. And, you know, it's very important right now, because I think the one thing that we should learn from the last year, the last couple of years, is that the truth that the politicians aren't going to make the change. They're not going to do it. It's got to come from the grassroots. If it takes longer or shorter time to build this movement, it's not going to happen any other way. But we are optimistic that there is a revival of anti-war and progressive movement in the streets that will be marked from this day forward.
All right. Richard Becker, if people want more information how to get involved or to join you, how do they do that?
Well, they should give us a call at our office, 415-821-6545, 821-6545, or go to answercoalition.org. It's all one big. We're going to be going forward after this toward March 20th, which will be the 7th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, to say end all these occupations, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Haiti. Money for people's needs. And also, adding to that, U.S. hands off Latin. That's a very important demand as well. So we need everyone to get involved. Give us a call. Go to the website. It's up to us.
All right. Richard Becker of the International Answer Coalition, thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now joining us from where he is stationed at Fort Hood, the recent scene of a mass murder, is U.S. Army Private Michael Kern. Kern is also a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he attempted to deliver an anti-war message to President Obama when he was at the funeral at Fort Hood for those who were recently massacred. They are also joining the discussion as Dar Jamail. Let me start with you, if I could, Private Kern. You were on, I guess, the base at Fort Hood as President Obama addressed the troops, the country from West Point. What was the sort of the feeling? What was going through your mind, and what were people saying on the base at Fort Hood?
Well, me personally, I kind of got in trouble, and I was yelling at the TV, you know. But other people were just, you know, well, we're going to do what we have to do. You know, they didn't really have that much response. I mean, a lot of people didn't watch it. They knew what was coming, and they were like, okay, whatever.
So we're hearing that this is, they're saying, President Obama is saying that this is it's a strategic necessity for the United States, as it was in Iraq, to go to Afghanistan and finish the job. How would you define, do you have any sense of what he means by the job? Finish the job?
Yeah, he said he wanted to give out a clear, mission of what we need to do there. And, you know, my friend put it a great way. He said, you know, this sounds exactly what I heard a few years ago when we were invading Iraq from another president. I mean, it sounds exactly the same to me, too. I mean, it sounds exactly like, you know, what Bush was saying. You know, we need to go in there and win the hearts and minds and, you know, have a steady government for them, and when we pull out, them to, you know, be able to control themselves, and, you know, that's not the factor.
You had some pretty terrible experiences in Iraq, killing civilians, killing at least one child. This is destroyed. You're thinking it's troubled your mind. You're struggling through this. What would you say? They're going to need a lot of soldiers to do this. What would your advice be to the soldiers who are getting ready or who might consider enlisting to go and fight and finish the job in Afghanistan?
Well, in the work that I do for Iraq Veterans Against the War and Under the Hood Cafe, I can't say that I don't want you to go, that I want you to resist to a soldier. I can't say that, but, you know, I support every soldier, I mean, whether they're pro war or against war, and, you know, if they say, you know, I believe in this war, and I'm going, and I'll be like, okay, I can respect that, go ahead. You know, me and you see different, but, you know, I can respect what your beliefs are. But, you know, for the others that are questioning it, you know, for example, there is things such as conscience objection. I mean, if you are religious and you think in your religion that is not okay to kill, you are able to apply for discharge. If you are just morally against the war, you can apply for a discharge to get out of the military with a good discharge, you know, if you don't believe in this kind of killing.
All right. Well, I know that you're not going to be going in for another tour, are you?
No, there's no way.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for your courage standing up as a soldier, as a private, still in the military, Michael Kern, private in the U.S. Army, speaking to us from Fort Hood, where there was that terrible tragedy not too long ago. Thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're joined again by Dar Jamil. And Dar has been investigating the situation, sort of the breakdown in morale, the upsurge in suicides, and really how the Army is trying to suppress the situation, not let people know what's going on, instead of deal with the real problem. Dar, you want to sort of talk a little bit about what's been going on, what you've learned since the shooting at Fort Hood?
Well, just talking about Fort Hood specifically, just since the shooting on November 22nd, police in Killeen, the town there that is right up nearby Fort Hood, on November 22nd, police there reported that a 20-year-old Fort Hood soldier was stabbed to death, and then the next day, a 22-year-old soldier from Fort Hood, Joshua Wyatt, was shot to death in his residence. And then the police also reported that both these soldiers are alleged to have been killed by other Fort Hood soldiers. And then when we have, when we look even a little bit closer at Fort Hood, also I'm aware of at least two suicide attempts that have occurred there by soldiers on themselves since the November 5th massacre. But this is not a new thing at Fort Hood. I mean, when we look back just over the last several years prior to November 5th, not including the incident on November 5th, in the previous 5 years alone, we've had several examples of soldier-on-soldier violence. There's been at least 7 deaths of soldier-related violence there, even before November 5th. So this is an ongoing problem at Fort Hood, and not just at Fort Hood either. For example, less than 12 hours after the massacre at Fort Hood committed by Major Hassan, when we look over at Camp Lejeune, the biggest Marine base on the East Coast, officials there found the body of a dead Marine and then took another Marine in custody who was accused of killing the aforementioned Marine. And when they took this guy into custody, he was also already suffering from self-inflicted wounds. So he had killed someone and then basically started to try to kill himself when he was taken into custody. And then we can move on up to upstate New York just in the last couple of days to a little town on the outskirts of Fort Drum. Between November 29th and 30th, we've had 2 soldiers there murdered by another soldier, according to the sheriff up there in that town. And this is just, you know, aside from the bits, that I mentioned happening at Fort Hood in the years leading up to November 5th, everything else that I've talked about has just been in the last few weeks. So this is clear, and this is just that we know of. This is just a quick scan of the news over the last couple of days for an article that I'm working on. So it's very, very clear that the military is in a state of crisis. These people are coming back. They're killing themselves. They're killing other soldiers. They're not being treated. And this is what happens when you redeploy soldiers. You don't give them mental health care. And then, of course, we can only begin to imagine how bad things are going to get right now at the very beginning of this time period after Obama announces sending 30,000 more troops into Afghanistan.
Dar, last night we spoke a little bit on our special around the speech about a psychologist or a psychiatrist who was fired from Fort Hood. Could you talk a little bit about how he was fired?
Well, his name's Dr. Kernan Mannion, and he was actually fired from Camp Lejeune. And I spoke with him at length yesterday. This was a guy who was hired on by a contractor to work there to treat Marines returning from both occupations suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And he was working for a contractor there at the Naval Hospital at Camp Lejeune treating people. And he started seeing problems. He had a couple of Marines come in and say, look, we have major problems going on here. We're actually being abused by our commanders when we come try to seek treatment. And if there's other kinds of problems as well. And if these aren't rectified, someone's going to come back here with a loaded weapon and lose it. Someone being a soldier with mental health problems. And so Dr. Mannion went on to start investigating the overall situation at the base. And by last spring, found things were so bad that he started basically writing a chain of memos up to his superiors and the people in charge of the situation and complaining about what he was saying and literally writing things like, quote, many patients' lives are imminently at risk, end quote, if things weren't improved. And people, for example, he was basically speaking to the fact that massive changes needed to be made. They needed more adept people in the military treating these people. The counselors needed counselors for them to debrief with because the stories they were hearing from soldiers were so extreme and so intense as they were coming back and processing what they did and what they saw happen over in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was repeatedly warning people, and then he finally issued this last warning that I mentioned about soldiers, his patients' lives literally being imminently at risk. And 4 days after that last warning, Mannion was fired by the contractor. So it was very clear when someone within this system, seeing how dysfunctional the medical care system in the military was, actually took it upon themselves to speak out and try to correct the problems. He was basically kicked out of that system. Basically said, pack up, you have 24 hours to clean your desk out, and an armed guard watch him clean his desk out and leave. Of course, leaving all of his patients, most of which having severe PTSD, needing dramatic treatment for their problems, basically leaving them hanging out in the cold, and there was nothing he could do about it.
Now, would you say that the military has a program to suppress information? I don't imagine they're helping you and providing the kind of material you need to do an extensive report. How do they deal with this or not deal with this?
Well, they deal with it really.
They fire people. That was one example.
Right, and that's basically what they do. They literally try to keep it completely under wraps. As Dr. Mannion told me, that literally the way he saw them trying to deal with it was by just trying to keep everything under wraps, by literally telling him, just stop talking about this. In fact, when he was in the process of writing the series of memos trying to alert his superiors to all the problems he was seeing, he was literally told at one point in an email, he received an email from his boss with his contractor saying, you need to stop doing this. You need to put a wrap on it, basically. You're causing trouble. And so that's basically how it's dealt with. People don't want to talk about the problem because, as he said, if people talk about the problem, then that means they're going to actually have to do something about it. And, and speaking to that, Dennis, I want to add something very, very important here that, Dr. Mannion gave me the exact letter. He sent a memo after all this happened. He sent his own letter to President Barack Obama and also sent it to the Vice President, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the people who head the Senate Committee on the Military, to many, many other people. And I want to quote one paragraph, one of the most important paragraphs that he wrote to Barack Obama about, trying to convey a sense of urgency of this crisis in the military. And Dr. Mannion wrote, quote, "Mr. President, given what I've witnessed and personally experienced, I think that, beyond the immediate issue of my firing and my patient's care, it's vital that these flaws be named and examined. Please know I am not a publicity seeker. I'm not pitching a product. I'm not trying to rise in rank, power, or compensation. I'm not even trying to restore my employment in government service. I have no agenda but to speak my truth on these matters and to confront these issues so as to ensure that these men and women receive the best of mental health treatment services that they're truly entitled to." And he sent this back at the end of September to President Obama. And when I asked him if he had received word back from either Barack Obama or any of the other people that he sent this letter to, when I asked him yesterday, "Did you receive a response from Barack Obama?" he simply said no.
All right. And finally, talk a little bit, Darjanelle, about the growing resistance movement. Is it safe to say that the movement is growing? And is it growing because more and more people are doubting the war effort?
It is. Both of those are true. I would say confidently that it's growing, and simply just looking at Pentagon figures on people going absent without leave, which is really, truly the only hard statistic we have to measure how, kind of as a barometer, is what is the mood in the military and how many people are leaving, and basically these numbers are going up recently. And since Obama took office, that number is increasing, as well as the number of people who are increasingly contacting groups like GI Rights Hotline and other soldier advocacy groups around the country. So we're seeing an uptick in those. But we are also seeing, even according to recent Army mental health surveys and reports come out by the Department of Defense, morale is low in both occupations, and now it's increasing severely in Afghanistan for obvious reasons. So, when we look at all of these factors of low morale, soldiers not getting the care that they need, record numbers of suicides every year in the Army from 2006 up to and including this year, and that trend is continuing to increase. And we add all these together and then throw in a president that just announces a 30,000 troop surge into Afghanistan, no end in sight to both these occupations. It doesn't take a genius to see this is a very, very fertile ground for GI resistance, and it is increasing.
All right, Darjanelle. And I don't have your book in front of me. The name of the book, people want to know more about your research on this.
It's called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Darjanelle, thanks so much for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks, Dennis.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our discussion of the impact on the military. And joining us now and their families are two members of military families directly impacted by the war. Georgia Stillwell Bissonette is an indigenous American and resides in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Her son served in Iraq and has severe PTSD. And also with us is Lisa Leitz. She is on the board of Military Family Speak Out, and her husband is still currently flying missions in Afghanistan. Well, let me start with you, Lisa Litz. Your husband is flying missions. Are you standing against the war?
I am absolutely standing against the war. I'm opposed to additional troops, and I believe that we should be bringing all of the troops home in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
So does that mean you oppose your husband's participation in the war?
I do. I believe that, you know, he signed up as a patriotic American to serve his country. And I think that we, as a country, are letting him and the rest of the military down by asking them to fight in wars that are both immoral and unwinnable.
Well, we know he's not going to comment during one of his flight missions, but do you discuss the issues? Does he support? Let me ask you this way. Does he support your decision to oppose the war?
Absolutely. He stands behind my First Amendment right to speak about my opinions on the war. And, you know, those are the kinds of rights that our military should be fighting to defend.
And hypothetically, as being very close to him, as his wife, do you suppose that if he was standing next to you, he would be holding a sign saying end the war?
I've never seen him hold a sign say as much, but he has certainly stood beside me as I've spoken out, and he's always telling me that he's proud of me for what I'm doing.
All right, what did you think of the speech last night?
It was honestly heartbreaking. As a military family, I just want to know, where are they going to get the troops? We're exhausted. We are completely beat down. I think we're talking about people who are going on their, in my husband's case, he's on his third deployment. Other people are on their fifth and their sixth deployment. It's a long time to be away from your family, a long time to be in war. And I know that my husband and other people like him are, their morale is low. They are incredibly, incredibly stressed. The kinds of things that they're seeing are the kinds of things that you don't want anybody to see. And
like what?
I mean, I'm talking about in terms of both the death of civilians, the death of even other fighters. But
has your husband witnessed the death of civilians? Has he killed civilians?
He is not. My husband is really incredibly fortunate because he's a pilot. He doesn't see what they do very often. He's also been very fortunate in the fact that he's never had to drop any ordnances in these wars. I don't know how he's managed to escape that, but as a pilot, he does get to make the call about when and where he drops things, and so far he's not had to do so. We are just unbelievably fortunate.
All right. Let's also just stand by a moment. Let's also bring into the conversation Georgia Stilwell Bissonnette. She's an Indigenous American. Her son is severely injured, suffering from PTSD. And she also has, a nephew that served already 3 times in the war. Georgia, welcome to Flashpoints. How is your son doing?
Well, we have good days and we have bad days. He has suffered since his return from Iraq. We've had the gamut of suicide attempts and chemical dependency and numerous difficulties with just functioning in civilian world. And, you know, he unfortunately has killed civilians and knows that he has and has to live with that on a day-to-day basis. At 19 years old, he killed civilians. And
does he talk to you about this?
Oh,
he killed a child?
Yes, he did. And he is traumatized from it, and he is haunted by it. He came home from Iraq alive, but he's dead inside. And as a family member, it's very hard to deal with and watch your once vivacious, happy with life, loving life son turn into a recluse with many difficulties.
Well, just talk a little bit more about the difficulties that you face.
Well, he has a hard time with anger and anxiety and loud noises, and he has had combat flashbacks and various other, the whole gamut that goes along with PTSD, the hypervigilance, driving in a car with him. He's still, you know, scanning the road for IEDs. They don't help them when they come back. The military does not help them. I feel the military turns their back. Our nephew, who has been deployed to Afghanistan 3 times, he's right now on his 3rd deployment, he came back, developed a chemical dependency problem, was treated for it, and resent back to Afghanistan. So the military is not taking into account. These troops are being used up. They're tired. They're exhausted. As a family member, you're tired. You're exhausted. When they're over there, your life just kind of goes on standstill. It's like you take a deep breath and you don't breathe until they come home. And then when they come home, you're walking around on eggshells and you're responsible for their care.
What kind of help does the military give you? Any?
We have not gotten any care from the military because it's also unacceptable to say that you have problems in the military. When you come back from war, they have you fill out a form and say, you know, did you kill anybody? Are you having any problems? But if you put that you're having problems, then you and your entire platoon will be held up for possibly 2 to 3 months. So no one is going to say that they're having problems when they return from the war.
And would you say, so is it safe to say that your son was punished for trying to get help?
I would more than say when he was punished. When he returned from Iraq, he started having some chemical dependency problems. He was court-martialed and put in a brig in Florida.
He was court-martialed and put in a brig after spending how much time fighting in the war?
1 year.
So he spent 1 year dodging landmines and bombs and bullets, facing off, as you say, killing civilians, including a child. He comes back, he says he's troubled, he's got some problems with drugs, and they put him in the brig.
Yes. And in fact, one of the statements my son made was that when he came back, he was told, you know, just drink it away by one of his superior officers.
Drink it away.
Mm-hmm.
So alcohol would be the answer.
Yes. Not, you know, maybe talking about it or getting help. So my concern is that we're going to have 500,000 some guys back here and women suffering from PTSD and not getting treated, and they're being turned loose in the streets. You know,
we're talking to you, Georgia, in the Black Hills of South Dakota. We know that there's a large indigenous Native American population. Are these wars having a very strong impact on that community?
Yes, because the most impoverished places are the highest place of enlistment. Per population, indigenous people have the highest enlistment rate. And I find it quite ironic that as indigenous people of this land, who knows better than how an occupation doesn't work? We are occupied people ourselves.
Well, that's mighty powerful. Well, in that context, why would your son join up? And did you try and oppose that or did you support that?
My son enlisted after 9/11, a few days after 9/11, he joined the delayed entry program. You know, he was feeling for the people of this country. As indigenous people, we're protectors of our land and our people. And so that's another reason he felt the need to join. But he was sent on a mission based on lies. And I am so feeling so deceived and betrayed by our president right now. It was wrong when President Bush did it, and it is wrong that Obama is doing it. I met with Obama.
You did in 2006, and what did he tell you? Did you think you were meeting with an anti-war president?
Yes, I did. I really did. I told him, you know, how I felt. I showed him pictures of some of my friends whose children have died. He seemed very empathetic. He was very intelligent, and he talked about, and I know on October 27th of 2007, you can even find it on YouTube, where he states that when he is president, the first order of business will be to bring our troops home and that we could take that to the bank. Those were his exact words. Well, he's a liar.
Well, your son ended up taking it to the brig. We just have a couple of minutes left. Let me invite you back, Lisa Leitz. I imagine the stories that we're hearing from Georgia are stories that you're hearing with military families speak out from all over the country.
Yeah, it is. And I do my research with veterans and military families who have similar experiences. So I hear these stories every day. And I have to be honest, these are the kinds of stories that I've wanted to stop since before the first bomb fell in Afghanistan. And it's the reason that I continue to speak out. I don't want David to have to live with these kinds of things. I don't want our friends. I don't want George's son. I don't want anybody else having to suffer this kind of way. And it's the reason that we say, bring them home now. And it's the reason we also say, take care of them when they get here, because our country is doing an absolutely abysmal job of taking care of our veterans and the military families who are also suffering. Military families are experiencing a tremendous amount of post-traumatic stress disorder that's sort of secondary. A lot of us, you know, it's the knock on the door that we all fear that makes us very jumpy, that causes us to have severe depression. It's causing children to act out in schools. And the families who are having to take care of their loved ones, because our Veterans Administration and our government certainly isn't, are losing their jobs, and they're stressed, and they're facing things that nobody in this country should have to face.
All right, and I want to give you the last moment, Georgia. If you had the president's ear again, a minute or two, and that's what we have, what would you tell him? What would be your message to President Barack Obama if you were the first person he spoke to after that speech at West Point last night?
I would tell him that I felt deceived and betrayed, and that the armed forces are not for bringing about social change. That is in the hands of the people of the countries that they live in. And he has put continued the Bush administration of putting our soldiers in harm's way for a lie.
All right. I want to thank you very much. That was the voice of Georgia Stilwell Bissonnette. Her son is suffering severe PTSD. She speaks to us from the Black Hills of South Dakota. And we've also been speaking with Lisa Leitz. Her husband is continuing to fly missions over Afghanistan. She is continuing to oppose the war. These are two very courageous women who are leading, really, in this country. Women are leading the battle to end this war. And we thank both of you for the courage. And Lisa, if people are suffering, how can they get information? How can they hook up with military families very quickly?
Sure. They can go to mfso.org.
And give that one more time. And is there a phone number as well?
mfso.org, or you can email mfso@mfso.org.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to the situation in occupied Palestine. As U.S. President Barack Obama expands the occupation of Afghanistan yesterday, outlining his plan to send an additional 30,000 American troops there, his administration continues to support Israel's spreading occupation and colonization of Palestine. Ma'an News Agency in the West Bank reports that during Obama's first 11 months in office, Israel's Interior Ministry stripped 4,577 Palestinians of their right to live in occupied East Jerusalem in 2008. Reports said this is an all-time record in 42 years of military occupation. The state figures were made public in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz today. The total was 21 times higher than the average of the previous 42 years. The 250,000 Palestinians with Israeli-issued East Jerusalem identity cards have the same legal status as people who immigrated to Israel legally, but are not entitled to citizenship. Haaretz quoted Israeli attorney Yotam Ben-Hillel of Hamoked, Center for the Defense of the Individual, as saying, quote, "They are treated as if they were immigrants to Israel, despite the fact that it is Israel that came to them in 1967. Because of their status as non-citizen residents, Palestinians in Jerusalem can easily lose their ID cards. Meanwhile, Israeli settler, military, and police forces have ramped up their seizure and demolition of Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem and across the West Bank. Backed by Israeli forces, Jewish settlers have expanded their illegal takeovers of homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem today and yesterday, while two homes were demolished near the West Bank city of Jenin this morning. Finally, in northern Gaza, Israeli forces arrested a young Palestinian man today after shooting him, according to medical officials. Israeli troops posted at the barrier between Beit Lahia town and Israel shot the youth, who was apparently collecting trash. Israeli forces prevented Gazan ambulances to attend to the young man, and then the army arrested him. This latest shooting comes on the heels of Monday's alleged attacks by Israeli forces, who opened fire against Palestinian houses and farmland in the northern Gaza Strip. Joining us to talk about the latest situation in Gaza is our special correspondent, Rami Al-Maghari. Rami is a reporter with Free Speech Radio News and the Electronic Intifada. He joins us from the Maghazi refugee camp. Rami, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Yes, Nora. Thank you.
Let's begin with some of the news coming out of Gaza, especially in the northern areas where Israeli snipers and army patrols have been opening fire on Palestinians over the last few days. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, Nora, what happened today is part of a series of ongoing series of Israeli frequent Israeli attacks and army on slots on the Gaza Strip from time to time. However, these are considered as small scale, but they're happening from time to time. Let me just recall last week when Israeli aircraft bombarded some points in Gaza, in the northern parts, in the southern and the middle parts of the Gaza Strip. Out of a sudden, the Israeli aircraft came over again to the Gaza Strip and targeted some points, which Israeli claims that these targets are said to be places for stockpiling weapons or homemade rockets or manufacturing these homemade rockets. These frequent Israeli attacks on the region actually are considered part of the Israeli ongoing onslaught on the Gaza Strip. However, the war ended in January of 2009. However, there is a sort of already declared a truce, a unilateral ceasefire by the Palestinian groups here in the Palestinian factions or armed factions in the Gaza Strip. Israel continues to attack the Gaza Strip from time to time. Let me give an example of this. As 2 weeks ago, the Palestinian Interior Ministry of the Hamas government, which is being boycotted by the international community and Israel as well. This ministry has called outright on the Palestinian factions, armed factions, to stop firing rockets among the Palestinian factions to stop firing rockets. Though this announcement by the factions here was declared and was made clear on media outlets, Israel continues to attack the Gaza Strip from time to time, having the justification that some rockets are being fired on southern parts of Israel. As for what happened today, particularly when the Israeli forces snatched a Palestinian man after shooting him, this incident happens often from time to time on the border areas between Gaza and Israel. And also, Israel always gives the justifications and the excuses for these attacks. Let me just say that most of the people who are being attacked or are being shot at in the border areas are farmers who have lands and the crops on the border lines between Israel and Gaza, and these people have been there for prolonged years, and and what Israel is doing is a sort of attack mainly on farmers or some residents living out there on the borders between Israel and the Gaza Strip. That's really the image for the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip for the past period, despite the announced ceasefire, despite the relative calm in Gaza. And this is really sort of a terrible and a very, very sad situation away from the humanitarian, the already deteriorated humanitarian situation because of the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip for the past 3 years now, maybe.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, Rami Al-Maghari, speaking to us from the Maghazi refugee camp inside the occupied Gaza Strip. And Rami, let's talk about the general humanitarian crisis inside Gaza. As you said, nearly 3 years into this expanding and suffocating blockade, the industrial crossings are still sealed most of the time, and there are still many items on the banned list. Talk about how this ongoing siege is continuing to affect the 1.5 million Palestinians trapped inside Gaza in terms of people being able to access basic medical care, food and water, and supplies such as textbooks and household items.
This is absolutely right what you have just said, Noura, that the situation is deteriorated from day to another as the Israeli blockade continues. The Israeli blockade on Gaza continues unabated. Actually, that's really the situation. The industrial sector is almost devastated. About 95% of Gaza's industrial facilities, local industrial facilities in the Gaza Strip, are shut down because of the Israeli blockade, which means that more than 70,000, it's estimates according to official estimates here from the industrial people, industrial organizations, about 70,000 people, 70,000 persons and workers actually are now staying idle, without work, have been rendered jobless because of the shutdown of the industrial facilities. This is a part of the situation. Another important part of the Israeli impact, the Israeli blockade's impact on the situation here, the economic conditions. You can say that the poverty rate is getting so much higher, about 65 or maybe more than 70% of the population are going under beyond poverty line according to international standards. I'm just saying international standards, more than 70% of the population beyond the poverty line, the line living. Also, the unemployment rate is increasing, and the increase of the unemployment rate is mainly due to the Israeli blockade, which has made most of the industrial facilities shut down, has made most of the border crossings of Gaza closed, and also has made the fishing industry, which is one of the main sources for living in the Gaza Strip. Fishing industry is crippled because of Israeli frequent attacks on the naval, frequent attacks on the fishermen, also the closure of the Israeli limits for the Palestinians to sail on Gaza, on board in Gaza, on Gaza shores. About 2 miles have been allowed, while the Oslo agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority allows about 12 miles of fishing along or on board of Gaza shores. Also, the agricultural sector has been suffering out of the economic conditions because of the Israeli blockade, as so many items, essential items, grains and also fodder for the livestock, for the animals here have been prevented from time to time. However, Israel allows some kind of goods or a number of goods into Gaza. Israel still prevents so many goods and so many commodities to the Gaza Strip. Let me just give you an example of the construction sector. The building sector in Gaza has been crippled because of the Israeli blockade or Israeli prevention of many items, many essential building items and raw materials from entering Gaza. The construction sector has been standstill for the past 3 years without any kind of movement. Also, many houses which have been demolished by the Israelis for the past several months, particularly in the time of the war in January of 2009, Several thousands of these homes have been rendered as a rubble. No one can rebuild these houses. Also, many other facilities, civil society facilities and buildings have been devastated completely or partially, and they are still being, they are yet to be rebuilt because of Israel's prevention of low building materials from entering the region and having the wheel of construction sector works again and things get to normal. This is a sort of a general scene of the situation. I think I'd like to tell you that also the Palestinian refugees, Gaza is, as you know, it's about 1.5 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. Majority of these of this population, majority of the 1.5 million residents, majority of them depend or rely on food aid and assistance by the UNRWA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East. And the UNRWA, as a main service provider for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, has been recently reported to have a sort of a deficit, a financial deficit, because of the international community's, international donors' inability or reluctance to pay, to transfer funds to the UNRWA, donations to the UNRWA to work properly in Gaza. This is according to UNRWA, to UNRWA officials in the Gaza Strip. This is a recent news about the UNRWA situation. So how can you imagine the situation in Gaza while the UNRWA, which is a main provider, service provider that gives, that offers the Palestinians here services, health and social and welfare services, is being crippled for the time being currently because of the upcoming deficit, which was according to the UNRWA itself is on the brink of a deficit, which means that many people who are staying jobless will not find opportunity to at least work for temporary jobs created by the UNRWA. Also, the many services that people benefit from, like the service of health and sanitation and sanitation and food, will be impacted by this kind of a deficit that is upcoming soon, according to UNRWA officials. So this is the situation, actually. UNRWA, a main service provider for the Palestinians, is having a sort of a bad situation for the time being. The Palestinians are being besieged by the Israelis. The border crossings are closed because of Israeli occupation authorities' orders. Also, the industrial sector is almost dead. The agriculture is very greatly impacted. The fishing industry, everything in Gaza is really going in the wrong direction, going in the bad direction, actually, in terms of the economy, in terms of the economic conditions and the living conditions for the 1.5 million residents who live in just 360 square kilometers about this very coastal strip, very limited. How can you, this is the situation in brief about the Gaza Strip for the time being, Nora.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.